Welcome to Alternative Realities, a podcast about the people, strategies, and stories driving the world of alternative investments. I'm Aaron Mulvihill, Global Alternative Strategist for JP Morgan Asset Management. And today I'm very excited to welcome on Jay Horion, Global Head of the Security and Resiliency Initiative for JP Morgan Chase. The Security and Resiliency Initiative is a 10-year, $1.5 trillion plan by JP Morgan Chase to facilitate, finance, and invest in industries critical to national economic security and resiliency. Part of that plan includes making $10 billion of direct equity and venture capital investments to help companies enhance growth, spur innovation, and accelerate strategic manufacturing. Today, I will be discussing with Jay why JP Morgan has launched this ambitious plan. We'll talk about the priority areas that the initiative will be focusing on and the role that private companies play in making innovation happen. Jay, thanks very much for coming on Alternative Realities.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate it, Aaron.
So before we kick off, I'd love to hear some more about your background, your career, before you were tapped to lead the initiative.
Thanks. Well, I've been here since 2006. And I came here to help run the Power and Utility Group. Doug Patno hired me when he ran Natural Resources. Then I ran Natural Resources. Then I had a chance to help lead our North American effort and then partner with Dorothy Blessing on the global coverage and industry effort. And then about 6 months ago, was tapped to run the Security and Resilience Initiative.
Very good. Well, we have a lot to talk about, but before we get into the Security and Resilience Initiative, I just want to set the scene. I'll read from an op-ed that Jamie Dimon wrote last year.
Yep.
The United States has allowed itself to become too reliant on unreliable sources of critical minerals, products, and manufacturing, all of which are essential for our national security. And this struck a chord with me. So in 2021, I was running a manufacturing business, and when COVID kicked off, it became extremely challenging to get a lot of products and materials from overseas, particularly. So computer chips, specialty steel. We had challenges with workforce kind of retention. A lot of folks chose to kind of prioritize their health, leave the workforce, and it was challenging to get people, you know, to trained up and replace those people. I think that was a wake-up call for a lot of folks in manufacturing about how vulnerable the global supply chain is. So from your perspective, how did we get here and what are some of the big gaps you see in the supply chain today?
Well, it's interesting you had that firsthand experience. I think Jamie was more right than any of us could have imagined when we began this. Mm-hmm. And it's been great to see the U.S. government, states, we've done a number of things with state initiatives, and now around the world joining this. And I think the first thing is the reality of understanding their supply chain and the weaknesses in that. Mm-hmm. We've hired a variety of people. Kevin Quinn joined us, Michael Johnson joined us, Sarah Rourke, Trevor Burns, a whole variety of people with different experiences, including supply chain. And I think one of the main places we have spent time has been supply chain. So we did a number of critical minerals deals. We've done some other deals I'm sure we'll talk about. But most of those begin with the resiliency of the supply chain and realizing that we did a lot of this to ourselves. We used to be the largest producer and refiner of critical minerals. We decided to not do that on purpose. We used to make most of these things ourselves. So it's kind of reimagining and coming back to things that we were good at. And we'll talk a little bit, I'm sure, about workforce and training and the like. But I'll just begin by saying there's a lot of good news. I think that what we found in these 5 or 6 months is a lot of really good news out there. It's going to take a little while. It's going to take money. But there's a lot of fantastic things going on.
So what is the Security and Resiliency Initiative? And what is JP Morgan prioritizing in taking on this challenge?
So it's a couple-fold. It's a $1.5 trillion effort over the next 10 years to finance and facilitate all the things that we've just been talking about. We also hired Todd Combs. He came off of our board where he had been the chief investment officer for Berkshire Hathaway to oversee what we're now calling an initial $10 billion of equity off of our own balance sheet, no limited partners. So it's an effort to work with everybody, companies, private, public, the government, state, local, federal, and around the world to bring all of these things back to play and to be a catalyst to that. So it's not just doing deals, it's also informing people so that they can go out and take advantage and do these things themselves.
So you've an advisory council that's made up of a who's who of global leaders. Can you give us a sense of who's helping you through this?
Well, I think, first of all, it shows, frankly, J.P. Morgan, but more Jamie's ability to convene. If you're on the council, you're really going to participate. It's and so we've seen that. We have people from our own board, Phoebe Novakovic, who's the CEO of General Dynamics, Alex Gorsky, the former CEO of Johnson & Johnson. General Dynamics makes the nuclear subs.
Okay.
Obviously, Johnson & Johnson, a leader in healthcare. We have people like Jeff Bezos, Michael Dell, who have joined on the technology and in advanced manufacturing side. People like Jim Farley of Ford Motor Company. We have a number of government officials, Condoleezza Rice and Bob Gates. We have also leaders from the military, Chris Cavalli and Ann Dunwoody. Paul Nakasone, who headed up cyber for the U.S. and is on the board of OpenAI. So a wide range of experiences. What's been fantastic, like Paul Ryan, the former Speaker of the House, I mean, I spoke to him yesterday, they are engaged. Alex Gorsky was on with us with the White House yesterday. These people have been fantastic and engaged.
So what are the priority areas that you're looking to allocate capital to?
So I think that Jamie laid it out pretty well when we started with the first area was defense tech. Obviously, we were relying on critical minerals to make magnets. Those magnets go in a variety of applications. We didn't have things like antimony. I didn't know what antimony was 6 months ago. It's used to harden lead for ammunition. So there was a big focus on helping to facilitate those things, which we did in deals for Perpetua and MP Materials and the like. So we started with that. There's also the energy side of things. There's frontier technologies. And advanced manufacturing. A variety of these areas, we've added pharma to this, where you begin with active pharmaceutical ingredients, key starter materials, sort of the basic building blocks of all of these. So there's been a variety of effort around, as I said, supply chain, advanced manufacturing, defense, aerospace, and then also energy independence and resiliency, things like nuclear plants and potentially things like nuclear fusion. So it's pretty wide. You try to keep it tight enough that you don't have scope creep, but sort of addressing in particular the things that we don't make ourselves anymore and how we can bring those things to bear. And again, there's a lot of really good news around this.
Fantastic. So you mentioned a couple of materials there that, you know, maybe we don't produce in the U.S. Rare earths have been particularly impactful in terms of thinking about supply chain challenges. What are the opportunities there in rare earths? Can you talk about, I guess, the challenge we have with rare earths and security of that supply, and then what can be done about securing that supply?
Well, I think the first piece of good news is that they're not that rare. And they are critical, though. And so we've sort of gone from rare earths to critical materials and critical minerals. There's a lot of them. Many of them you don't need much of. A lot of them are very difficult to pronounce. So you have a Korean company doing a zinc smelter in Tennessee, and they're the leading zinc smelter company in the world. And so the U.S. government partnered with them. And an example of there are a whole bunch of these minerals that come out of that. So if you look at Perpetua and MP Materials and that deal and other things we're working on, it's first been the identification of that as a need, the identification of what needs to be done, the various issues around them, and then the U.S. government also has a variety of other initiatives to potentially have a storehouse of those things, Project Vault, to things like Pax Silica and others. So it's gone from kind of nothing to well engaged, and now they're you know, the next area will be a lot of early stage pharma and other things that are the building blocks for manufacturing.
Okay, what are some examples of products or materials that we do not produce today in the U.S. or we don't produce in sufficient quantities?
Well, there are lots of interesting factoids that you can go through around things like antibiotics and other things that the U.S. doesn't really make. An example, 90% of critical pharmaceuticals and the ingredients needed to make vaccines, antibiotics, and pain medications are now imported.
90%.
90%. That's a lot. And it's from a very concentrated group of countries. So you start to think about how can we start to do more of those things ourselves? Mm-hmm. What are the costs? What are the gating items, if you will? Where would you want to do them and the like? And so that's just one example. I think the critical minerals is another example. But you also then start to get into more manufacturing, making more and more things here, what we can do, what the cost differential is. And I think that's where people like Michael Dell and Jeff Bezos and others, remember, this is, we have 25 on our way to 30 people in our group, but we're tapped into the entire, Jamie, the operating committee, the leaders across the firm have really embraced this and been super helpful at bringing all these companies to bear with their ideas and creativity. So you said, well, we can't do that because it's going to cost $100. And people raise their hand and say, hey, I think I can make it for $80 or $70. You start to break the cost curve down. And then as you make more of them, what can we do on that front? So you're going to see U.S. used to make build lots of nuclear plants. The government and variety of companies are trying to reimagine how to do that, as well as things like fusion as opposed to fission. So a lot of innovation that's also helping the cause.
So a big topic is that we're starting to kind of get into this, the skilled workforce shortage generally, whether it's welders or you've had a lot of folks that are just leaving the workforce with a lot of knowledge. Like where can we apply innovation to fix this challenge? Is AI going to be part of the solution? Is it still a people solution? How do you see this evolving?
I think, like many things, it's kind of all of the above. Mm-hmm. We're doing a bunch in robotics, for instance. There will be a robotics solution. There'll be a skilled labor. There'll be semi-skilled labor. A lot of these things are apprenticeship businesses where, for a reasonably modest amount of money, you can go and get trained in a reasonably short period of time, like to be a welder. There are different levels of welding, and then you can enter into apprenticeship programs and the like. So you can imagine schools being put around large manufacturing sites. There are almost new cities being created. We're down at one in Texas, for instance, where there's literally new cities in being built around large manufacturing sites. So when someone like Micron is going to do a $100 billion facility in New York, or what TSMC is trying to do in Phoenix, or some of the things going on in Texas and around the states, they create almost like a city. And then that's where welding and all of these trades that are incredibly valuable, they're high paying, they're really interesting jobs, and you're building something to be proud of. Mm-hmm. I think that we're going to see, very confident that there'll be a renaissance in the trades around the U.S.
Yeah, it needs to happen.
It needs to happen.
There's a massive gap there, and it takes a long time to train somebody like a welder, not just
it does,
school, but giving them opportunities.
The best day to start is today. Yeah. And so and I think that there's going to be a lot of interest in that, which is fantastic.
So on this podcast, we talk a lot about private companies, the role of venture capital, private equity. How important are private companies in this story?
I think one of the things that I was pleased and a bit surprised by was the role of venture capital in these communities. The role of venture capital in defense tech, for instance, is very large. People like Anduril and others that have been started by the VC community. So very large presence, people like A16Z, working with a variety of our colleagues, Larry Landry, others, to envision new ways to finance these companies. Very often, they're building factories and making things and using venture capital equity, venture capital debt. We're working with them to try to envision new ways that allow to larger quantums and at a lower cost, which just accelerates everything. So again, partnership across the firm with risk, with leadership across banking. It's sort of a community effort to, and the private companies are driving a lot of this, in part because we don't have as many public companies as we used to. But a lot of these companies also make a lot of money, and so they don't necessarily have that need to go public,
right.
At least from that standpoint. But we are working hand in glove with them. There's a regulatory side. There's a, again, state, local, and federal side. And it's sort of a partnership. But the private sector is thriving right now. And again, we're working with public and private companies to try to make this future happen.
Yeah. And that's something we see is that the private companies can just move much faster as well, because regulation is sometimes a challenge. The public companies have to go on CNBC every morning and kind of talk about what they're doing. And that's a lot of time from CEOs and the leadership teams, whereas private companies can just move very, very quickly. They can raise capital relatively quickly and just go and execute.
We're seeing a number of these companies, many of whom will go public, but we're also seeing the scaling. The fact that they go from making one widget to 10 widgets to 100 widgets in such a fast time period. And so that aspect of it, using AI, using robotics, using other things to actually make stuff, physical, tangible things that you can put in a factory, that come out of a factory, that are used, new kinds of cars, new kinds of materials, new kinds of ships, hopefully, in the future. The scaling side and kind of the boldness, the fearlessness of these companies is really fantastic, and we're trying to latch onto that and bring that to bear with our other companies, like what Jim Farley's doing at Ford and some of the other people that we're working with.
Which is very new for venture capital, because when you think traditional venture capital, it's a couple of guys in the garage making an internet application.
Well, take a look at A16 raising a $15 billion fund. The dollar amounts are becoming so huge. You see these, and we want to make sure that we're part of that.
So you've got a lot of areas you're in. How do you prioritize, or do you have certain buckets you put your focus areas in?
I think one of the interesting things about JP Morgan is, on the one hand, you do want to prioritize, but on the other hand, we bank cover small, medium, large, public, private, U.S., not U.S., venture-backed, private equity-backed, founder-started, kind of the entire landscape. And so what we're trying to do is work with our partners across the bank so that we can identify areas we want to address, but that we don't have to necessarily do A, and we don't have enough people or time to do B. So we've hired a number of people to help work with our colleagues and partners to reach out and, as I said, become partners with the VC community and the private equity community. The legal community, people are engaged in this. And I think that all the way back to your initial words, when Jamie started this, he really touched a nerve. And I think that there, people want to help the United States of America. People want to help everybody, around the world, sort of get to that next level to be a little bit more self-reliant, but also to kind of help get to a better place. And I think he really touched that. And I think that we are serving in a leadership role right now.
Jay, thanks very much for coming on the podcast. It's been great talking to you.
Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
That was Jay Horion, Global Head of the Security and Resiliency Initiative for JPMorgan Chase. To all our viewers and listeners, thank you very much for listening to the Alternative Realities podcast. You can download the quarterly guide to alternatives on the JP Morgan Asset Management website at jpmorgan.com/GTA. And if you've not already done so, please subscribe to Alternative Realities on your favorite podcasting platform.
This material is for information purposes only. The views, opinions, and statements of financial market trends that are based on current market conditions are those of the speaker, and may differ from those expressed by JP Morgan Asset Management or by other areas of JP Morgan Chase & Company. Any companies referenced are shown for illustrative purposes only and are not intended as a recommendation or an offer or solicitation for the purchase, sale, or tender of any financial instrument. This is not a product of the research department of J.P. Morgan Securities LLC. We believe the information provided here is reliable, but should not be assumed to be accurate or complete. The views and strategies described may not be suitable for all investors. This content is intended for information only based on assumptions and current market conditions, and are subject to change. No warranty of accuracy is given. This content does not contain sufficient information to support investment decisions. It is not to be construed as research, legal, regulatory, tax, accounting, or investment advice. Investments involve risks. Investors should seek professional advice or to make an independent evaluation before investing. The value of investments and the income from them may fluctuate, including loss of capital. Past performance and yield are not indicative of current or future results. Forecasts and estimates may or may not come to pass. J.P. Morgan Asset Management is the asset management business of J.P. Morgan Chase and Company and its affiliates worldwide.